I had a math teacher once who, I guess he was fairly clumsy. At any rate, he would always break the chalk. And every time he broke the chalk, he said, "Oh, now I have two pieces of chalk. See, it created matter." This forum, in that sense, was creative already. There were two groups that had been split, and half of the people, or a portion, were over in the center. But I think most of you have arrived now, so we can begin. I thought I would try just to introduce the problem in a way that perhaps some of you haven't thought about. Perhaps some of you have thought about it quite a bit. But at least it's my impression that there are a couple of issues which are frequently viewed as having little to do with each other, that, at least in my mind, seem to have some common points. Perhaps they're the same issue. So I thought I'd like to talk very briefly about each of these issues, and then suggest a way in which we might see a connection between them, and then pose a question that seems to occur to me: if you consider these issues as having some common foundation, and then perhaps some of you will have some notions about how this question can be answered. The first question is sometimes put, what good are the arts? Or does society need art? Isn't art a kind of luxury? Can't we, in times of need, cut back on the arts before we cut back on more essential things? If you have to make a choice in a city between funding an art gallery or a municipal symphony or something, and the sanitation department or a mass transportation system or the schools or something, many people would say, well, we'll have to cut the arts first, because after all, that's only a luxury, that's something that we don't need. It seems to me, at any rate, this is a fairly widespread view. The question is, what is the value of the arts in society? One proposed answer is that, well, they're kind of a luxury and we can do without them. That seems to suggest that the arts are fairly benign. Take them or leave them. If you have them, it's nice, but if you don't have them, things are just about the same. Now, another view in response to this question suggests that the arts are very important, but suggests that not only are they important, but they are so important that unless they are regulated and controlled in a certain way, they're apt to have the wrong effect on society. That if you were to just give artists complete license to do as they desired, the society might suffer something for it. We all know that in societies such as the Soviet Union, for example, there are official philosophies of art, and artists are expected to conform to a particular school of aesthetics. And if they don't, the art simply is excluded from any kind of exhibition. And if they insist on trying to propagate this art, they themselves may be censored, and perhaps even more serious consequences. I remember a news article describing the charming reaction of Nikita Khrushchev to an outdoor art exhibit in Moscow 1 year. Perhaps some of you remember and can fill in the rest of the historical details, but in order to indicate that what was on exhibit simply was decadent and out of tune with the official outlook, Mr. Khrushchev mounted a bulldozer and drove around and squinched it down. So there is this view, the view that the arts can, in some sense, be the servant of those who would control or manage or direct society, but that you have to be very careful what art you allow and what art you don't allow. And perhaps some of you saw in the paper early this spring that after quite some time, now the libraries in China are being opened again for Western authors like Shakespeare and so on. The point of view was that, no, to read Shakespeare, to read Goethe, to read Pushkin, to read Stendhal and so on, would have a detrimental effect on the development of that society. So that's the second kind of response. Yes, the arts are very important, but they're more likely to have a detrimental effect on society, and therefore to have the best of all possible societies, we ought to stifle them or at least control them. Plato, the Greek philosopher, in his design of what was to be the most just city, the perfect city really, had a very strong system of censorship built in, and really went so far as to ban the poets from the city. So there's that notion that society will be best without art. If we allow art, it's because the society is strong enough that it's not going to be hurt by it, but if there's some sort of need to cut something out, the first thing that will go is the arts, you see. Okay. Now that suggests that art isn't very important to society in a positive sense at all, and may be significant in a negative way. Now, the other question that I would like to raise this evening, and which is, I think, frequently discussed as quite a different question, is what is the creative impulse? Or what is a creative process? Or what does it mean to be creative? What do creative people do? Or what are creative people like? Are they odd people who are listening to, you know, odd voices and somehow responding? Or are they problem solvers who work really hard and come up with new solutions, you know, sort of the Thomas Edison analysis of creativity? It's what, 1% genius and 1% inspiration and 99% perspiration. It's simply a matter of doing it, you see, and that all of us could do the same thing if we were simply more tenacious. Is it something that one does when one has leisure, but only when one has leisure? Is it something that fills your time after you've taken care of other things? You've provided your basic survival needs. You have food and shelter and clothing. You're warm and dry and well-fed, a certain amount of security, and so on and so forth. And having taken care of that, you have some leisure, and now what are you going to do? Well, I'm going to dabble in painting, a phrase that was used a couple of times in the session earlier this evening, or I'm going to play at this or that. It becomes a form of recreation, something that you could easily do without, something that if you had a pressing survival need, you would do without. Or is it perhaps something which agency takes you over and perhaps isn't very good for you. I mean, I know parents of college students who hope very much that their children are not going to study art, or if they do study art, are not going to study art very seriously because, you know, that's bad for you. I mean, to say my son or daughter is an art major or is interested in poetry or something is, in the minds of some people that I've met, not so different from having a social disease. You know. My son, the poet. Now, you see, the way I've talked about this, it seems to me that there's a kind of parallelism that should be fairly obvious between the way in which we look at the creative process as it occurs in individuals and the way we look at arts as they manifest themselves in societies, a kind of city-soul parallelism or something like this. And two views. It's something that's benign, a luxury, something that the city can do without, but if it has it, it's something like the recreation of the city, not important. Again, something in the individual, which you can do without, but if you have leisure, it's a nice kind of entertainment. Okay? There's that view and a certain parallel there. Or the other view that it's essentially destructive and demonic, it possesses individuals and is not good for them, or at least needs to be very strongly regulated in individuals, and you're very concerned that your son or daughter, if they become interested in poetry or painting or music or something, do it the right way and don't get too carried away with it and don't let it really direct their lives. Similarly, in the city, in the society, arts are all right provided they're regulated, provided we have the right kind of censorship. It's all right to have community drama, it's all right to have municipal art galleries, but you don't want certain kinds of paintings or certain kinds of plays, and so on and so forth. Okay? Now, with that sort of joining together of the individual and society and the creative process and the arts as they manifest themselves in society, I want to suggest that it may be empirically the case that there's something about art which runs very deep, which is not something which people only engage in as a casual sort of recreation, either on the individual level or on the social level, that in a society which is particularly beset with difficult survival needs, we have evidence that art nevertheless was part of life there. What I have in mind is the recent exhibit of what's called Ice Age art, that is art from around 35,000 to 10,000 BC, prehistorical art. Let me just read a couple of very brief paragraphs about this exhibit to suggest what was happening in a society which was obviously one of little leisure. The cave paintings and mobiliary art, that is portable sculpture, that date from the Ice Age, around 35,000 to 10,000 BC, constitute the earliest art known to mankind and probably man's first symbolic as opposed to utilitarian creations. That is, creations which were not something for particular use. We're not talking about the making of tools or pots or spoons or something. We're talking about making things which have simply a symbolic value. The small carved figures and paintings of animals, abstract signs, and occasional human figures that adorn the walls of Lascaux and Altamira, the two most famous caves located in southern France and northern Spain, are of inestimable importance not only because they represent the origin of art, but of communication, language, in the form of images. A couple of examples. The exhibition's contextual focus does in some respects distract, though not detract from the art itself, but is enormously helpful to our appreciation of the art as a phenomenon. The exhibition apprises us of a multitude of relevant facts, for example, that the artists and the people to whom they belonged invented the spear thrower, sewed their clothes, buried their dead, wore jewelry, styled their hair, and played musical instruments. Moreover, with regard to the art, they were masters of several techniques, from finger painting to brush painting and blowing. Most intriguing are the similarities among the paintings and the Venus figures from the diverse parts of the world, from Siberia to southern France. And then there's some other analogies made with some contemporary artists, Daumier, or more or less contemporary, Daumier, Miró, and others. Here's an example. I'll pass this around, and if any of you want to look at it, you're free to. Now, the question that I want to throw out and let people respond to is life without art worth living? Yeah.
I guess that has to be a very personal question, but it seems to me that it's the same, that in a way it's asking the question of whether or not life without meaning it has any value. Because it seems to me that essentially creativity and expressions of life and objects or ideas or expressions which in turn create new life are concerned with the question of meaning on some level or another, and it's the danger inherent in meaning anything that both create the attack on art, the fear of it, the anxiety, I think not only are in social and in political ways, but in very personal ones too. It's really a challenge to be have it suggested that you can be a creative individual, or that you in some way ought to create or ought to experience things in a meaningful way. That creates the fear, first of all, that you can't, or that perhaps there is an oughtness about your life that you're not, well, it's the same thing, that you're not able to achieve. And so I think that that's where our humanity is. The measure of our humanity, a sign of our being creatures as well as creators, and affirming that place, which is a tension between receiver and giver. And that's a very dangerous place. It's dangerous to people who want to lay meaning on others. And it's dangerous to people who feel that they themselves cannot mean, have meaning, express meaning.
No, I think you've therefore said no. Because life without art would be meaningless, because it is art which makes meaning. And then the making of meaning is a threatening and controversial and dangerous business. Is that?
I think that it's in relationship between those things. It both expresses and creates. Yeah.
I think what I want to say is I don't think the question has any meaning, because I don't think life without art is possible. So I don't know whether it can be worth it or not. For example, where in World War II in the concentration camps, the Jews, some of them did art even when it was forbidden, and just whether it was destroyed or not, it's just many people's way of expressing, it's the only way of expressing themselves is through their art, and I don't think it's possible to have life without art in one form or another.
And the expression is an attempt to give meaning to a situation regardless of how
not in
difficult or threatening that situation is,
and that
not to give meaning to the situation is tantamount to giving up, that you might as well be dead, you're saying then.
Yeah.
I'll
go along.
Or did you mean it as an empirical assertion that nobody can do anything without, we're all artists, we're all
poets. No, I think art is
just coming out of us, all over.
I think art is a result of life, and that with life you cannot exclude art, or you cannot have any sort of civilization that doesn't produce art.
Are you thinking of creativity in relationship to art, like painting or sculpture, or creativity in general? I think there's a lot of areas that there's creativity going on that isn't in the line of painting or sculpture.
Yeah, pursue that, because I deliberately avoided that in the parallelism that I developed. That was left out, but it's really at the heart of the question. Can you develop a little bit more?
Well, I'm thinking of creativity, to be able to create a hot dish out of leftovers, or tie a scarf a little differently to make it attractive is creativity.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's important.
Well, let's take the hot dish example. Why is that creative? I mean, what goes on? I've never done this sort of thing, so I've
been made before.
Yeah.
Or maybe you're putting some things together that has never been put together before, but you know.
In order to be able to eat.
Yeah.
Oh.
To be able to, I think the parade on the 4th of July was a sign of creativity. They were using things that were available in creating something that was interesting, attractive, fun, just out of things that were there.
So you're suggesting then that what is important is that we make the best use of the materials that are available to us, putting them together in innovative ways, in order that we might best serve the needs of either our most basic needs to eat or whatever, figure out how to create a shelter when you're caught in the rain at Heart Lake, as I was this afternoon. Or to serve some agreed upon socially desirable kind of thing. We're going to celebrate the 4th of July, and we ought to be innovative and creative in doing that.
And the satisfaction that's gained.
And anything that would go beyond that, would you suggest? I mean, that's kind of a luxury that we can do without. I don't want to put words in your
mouth. Beyond that.
Beyond the innovative use of materials that are at hand to serve needs, whether they're individual needs or whether they're socially agreed upon needs. But just the urge to do something for the sake of doing it, and nobody can say what good it's going to do. I'm not going to make a hot dish. I'm going to make something else that'll be in the way all the time, you see. But I just wanted to do it.
That may be art, but that isn't the substance of creativity. What you're saying is that the non-functional object that is created can be considered art. Whereas if it's functional, it's not art, but nevertheless creative.
Well, I was just asking whether or not it was important that we be able to deal with practical matters creatively, but that it's not important whether we're creative beyond dealing with practical matters. That's really the question. Yeah, I think there are a couple of hands in the back, Julie, and then you know, Mike, you're down. I guess your hand was floating up first. Yeah.
I decided to sit on the floor in case I fell asleep. I wouldn't support a phone.
That's creative.
Yeah. As long as you don't feel lonely down there.
If we're trying to define, it seems like we're trying to define creativity in art. I was just thinking by way of a definition that all art is creative, but all creativity isn't art. I'm not sure where that goal is, but it seems like that would be the first step in separating the two and forming some definitions.
All art is creative. In some societies, what's called art is not the result of innovation or imagination very much. So I don't know that it's helped. Yeah.
I don't know if this helps either. I think that these questions that we're talking about are extraordinarily difficult, thorny questions that I certainly think about and a lot and haven't come to very many conclusions about. But something that has struck me for a long time, and you're bringing up the Ice Age exhibit, brought it back, and I think it's very important, is that in those very early societies, as far as we know, we don't know very much. We just have those things that were on the cage, you know, and some tools. It seems as if that the making of those pictures on the cave and those kinds of non-functional objects, they don't seem to have any function of you know, cooking with or anything like that, was looked upon as a magical act. The cave at Lascaux seemed to imply, for the archaeologists that study them, that there was some way in which the making of the image of those animals, those cattle, would allow the people to maybe capture one. That it had a magical and possibly religious function, mystical. And some of the things that have been found, you know, that I've seen reproductions really, really feel that way to me. And I know for me, when I think about art, there's a quality of magic in it. And what Ruth was saying about meaning, that it's a way of transcending the utilitarian and the functional, that it puts some magic around. It's mysterious in some ways. And I think that in those societies, that wasn't separate from life, from the life. There isn't that impression that the people that made those things were set apart particularly, although the shaman was the leader that maybe made them. In our day, the arts have become, it seems to me, very separate from life. We have culture, we have the Arts Commission, and then we have the repertory company, and we have the dance company, and they're all kind of institutions that the rest of us go to, and we see the ballet or we hear the symphony, but we don't live among it in that way. So it seems to me that the distinction between the utilitarian and the, what is it, non-utilitarian, the symbolic, is more recent, isn't it?
And I think you're talking about two distinctions.
Yeah.
I mean, the distinction between symbolic expression and the making of utilitarian artifacts is one thing, but I thought that you were suggesting that what we've done is to segregate the arts out and somehow say that that's really not part of our life.
Yeah.
Whereas in earlier societies, perhaps in the societies that these cave drawings and sculptures represent, the arts, which we now have segregated out, were really a part of every part of our life. Every part of life.
Well, even later, I think Egyptian society.
Sure, yeah.
I don't think we have to go all the way back. Have that quality about it. What I mean is that in that, then that distinction between, I don't imagine that came up, in other words, for the Ice Age folk, whether it was symbolic or functional. You know, the question about the hot dish and the making of an apple that gets in the way, I doubt whether that came up.
William?
Well, I couldn't help being struck by this notion of a couple of things that were said here. That thing about the creative cooking is struck a familiar note, because a guy by the name of Maslow said that he had what he thought was one of the most creative mother-in-laws around, because she could do more in the kitchen than most of the bad poets that he knew, you know, in terms of a creative way. But he said another useful thing. He said, what a man can be, or what a person can be, he must be. And that opens up the whole notion of, is creativity something inborn response capability from a psychological point of view? And I think we'd have to say that one of the response capabilities that we are born with is the capacity to transform our world in whatever way it may be. Now, in earlier history, surely that transformation process may have been addressed to some very concrete problems. How do we transform the world to make it work for us? The creation of tools was certainly a creative act, but it was serving a utilitarian base. But it seemed parallel to that. That transformation process seemed to be repeated, even though there was no utilitarian function. So in a sense, it looks like a transformation process, or the creative act, if you want to put it that way, seems to be part of a man's basic equipment, that he has to engage in the enterprise to be what he is, just biologically.
So that we can't avoid it. No.
I have to apologize to you, Candy. I have laryngitis. This may sound terrible if you can hear it. I agree that man doesn't have a choice, that everybody is created. For a very basic reason, if you accept the idea that God created people and breathed into man the breath of life, or breathed into people the breath of life, then everybody has that creative urge, that little bit of chipped off bit of brilliance, as D.H. Lawrence called it. And Wordsworth said that children come from heaven trailing clouds of glory. And I think as we get older, those clouds of glory take on more and more layers of chaff until they've diminished. But they're all there. I teach a class in creativity every year for a month. And we work with students and work with ballet and symphony. We paint, we junk sculpture, we draw, we paint, to all of us. Everybody does it because we start with the assumption that it's natural things to do. We don't ask whether it's utilitarian or whether it's just for fun. It's just natural as getting up and drinking water, watching sunrises, making love, walking on the beach, climbing the copper basin. There's no hierarchy. Creating is something one does because one is. And with that assumption, everybody creates. Interesting enough, and then the class is over, 75% of them stop.
You suggested, and maybe you were suggesting too, Wayne, that all creative acts are, in some sense, equally meritorious or worthwhile, significant. Did I hear you right in that? Or?
Well, some transformation processes are more powerful than others and have more generalizability than others. And I suppose in that respect, we choose to call those that are powerful and perhaps not serving utilitarian purposes, maybe we categorize them as art. I'm not even too sure I understand that process altogether. But I just, whoever created this phrase, I just would love to meet him. He described all this enterprise as serving those priceless non-essentials of living. And I think it says it so well, those priceless non-essentials of living, where we indeed create, not because it serves our belly, but it's essential, non-essential, but priceless.
It seems to me that through creativity of perhaps the non-utilitarian type gives a great communication, a depth of communication between people that we might not get otherwise.
That seems almost difficult to call it non-utilitarian because it does have a use. And the use may be a higher order use. It may not be a, like I said, fill your belly or maybe you don't sleep under it. But it still has a use for your higher order needs. The emotional needs and other needs are met by it. And so I don't think you can even call any type of art non-utilitarian.
That is asking about utilitarian values is like asking what value is rose to me, or what value is the smell of a baby, or a puppy's tummy, or a sunset. You just don't ask, I don't think you ask what value those things are. They should be obvious. They're beautiful. And that's something you accept because people have that inborn sense of beauty. And art, in all its many facets and shapes, strikes chords within us. Everybody responds to it. Sunset, to love, to the smell of a baby. Everybody responds to the pussycat. Art. Part of life. I agree with Julie. About she fainted.
She had to go to a very good person.
All right, I'll tell her I agree, Paul. that this compartmentalization of artists as opposed to somebody else is a fairly recent phenomenon.
There's a film, I haven't seen it, that really summarizes it for me. Why Man Creates.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
if you've ever seen that film, it assumes that from the beginning, man was created. And it's a cartoon, in the beginning of the episode, there's a cartoon of the little caveman, and he runs out all alone, and he's trying to spear the giant beast for dinner. And it isn't working. So then they discover that if he uses two other guys and he is the bait, then they can trap him and he falls in a hole, and then they all get something to eat. So the film is called One Man Creates, and it assumes that from man's earliest beginning, he was created, and that he could go on sort of Maslow's hierarchy of needs, that as man, Maslow said that man in the beginning had very little time other than finding food, but that even then in this film assumed that he was created. And then as time passed, he had more time to put into more levels of creativity until we've gotten to the point today where I agree with Julie also that we have completely separated almost from our daily life. And this film carries that through. I wish if you haven't seen that film, it's just tremendous because it carries that whole idea like through the state, all the stages in history right down to the day. For me, it
takes
it in a beautiful way.
Okay, now I think that, let me try a quick summary of what some people have have said, aren't you suggesting that creativity is something which goes on as a matter of course in individuals and in societies, there's really no need to set aside special facilities or a special time to do it or to grant it a special status, that what we have, I think all of us will understand what I mean when I say the arts or the fine arts or something, that the tendency to set these aside is actually either a mistake or something we do because we have extra resources or extra leisure or something, but that it's not really essential, that we're all creative and that creativity is going to go on. Now, I mean, the question is there any value in identifying art as a primary vocation or recognizing a special place in society for the artist or for the arts? Now, I know there are several hands. Paul, your hand is not full.
Yeah, I formulated this before you asked that question, but I think in response to it, there's no, it's very improbable that anyone in a discussion like this is going to come out and attack art. There's a position that's not being taken here. And the person who might want to take it maybe is incompetent to take it. I want to suggest it might have something to learn. It might keep us from sort of waffling around in vague good things said about creativity and art. Ask why the leaders of the Soviet Union, who were very serious men, took the attitude toward some art, right, it was some, that they did. Why did these men regard some artists as dangerous to the state? I don't have an answer to that. But here clearly are some people in our time, very serious, deeply concerned about society, their society, who took risks in order to suppress artists. They weren't playing around. Why? What exactly was it that I know that used to?
Okay, yeah.
I think that can be partly answered, and some of the things that I think Judy, I'm not sure her name is saying.
Ruthie.
Art is an attempt to communicate or to be part of the transcendent, something higher, something beyond God, however you want to say that. You can see it in, at least I can, in religious art, in liturgy, in things like that. And I think that can relate to political systems, that leaders might well be frightened of people who don't recognize their authority, but reach for something beyond that, something, the essence of life, I guess. Art tries to do that. And our society has so delineated what is art and what is not art, and that most of us don't have opportunity to really do art, that we become spectators in what someone else is doing in trying to be part of that essence of life.
Okay, now two points of view at least are floating around. One says that works of art mean something, and that this meaning may have political consequences and may be controversial for that reason. Another point of view that's been said is that works of art really don't mean, they simply are. Now, Wayne, you're...
I really would like to try a whack at that one, because I think it's an important question. And that is, I think the Soviet, any work of art is basically a threat to what has been going on before it. In the instance in which Paul was mentioning, of course, this is a political threat, but basically it upsets the conventional way of looking at things. Now, if it has large generalizability, that might have large social consequences. And if I remember correctly, the Soviet Union repressed those artists who deviated from representational lines. And it seemed to me that what they were interested in was to convey a rather specific and narrow message to this. But the essence of the artistic experience, it seems to me, is the very idea of indirection. That is, the capacity to bring multiple responses to this instead of a rather restricted one. And so what was happening was the Soviet artists, it seemed to me, who were offering possibilities for expansion of the imagination, was that it was threatening the system, the notion of a conveying a rather limited thought. And therefore, I think representational art, for whatever the criticism that receives, I think it's valid in this respect, is that it allows too limited a response to it. That served the purposes of the Soviet government, but it did not serve the purposes of artistic expression.
Okay, you've been
answer the original question along the same line here. And I'm talking about creativity and utilitarian creativity in this case. And I'm sure it applies to art. That as order has creeped into our lives over the last many years, we live under a great deal of order. There are rules and regulations for almost every aspect of our life. This has also forced creativity out, because order does kill creativity. That is to say, if we must hew to a line, we cannot be creative. So that a person must separate himself from that ordered society in order to create, in order to try these other possibilities. And in terms of utilitarian creativity, it's recognized that the only way to allow a person to be creative is not to hamper him with a whole bunch of rules, not make him produce something every day, but just to let him work on solving the problem in a creative manner, and not expect order out of him, not expect productivity in the general sense of the word. So I think that's why the artist probably is set apart too. He cannot function in an ordered society.
Just on a sideline, it's also interesting to note that it doesn't seem to matter what kind of regime artists live under, they produce just as well. Whether it's someone who's in favor with the Soviet Union, as the poet Yevtushenko is now, or the novelist Sholokhov, or someone like Solzhenitsyn who's out of there and spent half his life in prison camps. Not the regime itself doesn't matter as far as creativity. If you're creative, you're going to be creative on Mars. But the thing about Khrushchev demolishing that thing too, as you were pointing out, when we go through a revolution like that and they get rid of the Tsar because of the Tsar's eating cake and the rest of us are grubbing about the roots and things, and starving to death, there's this great upheaval to get rid of frills and get back to basics and make the system work. And those solid kind of rock, wood, chunk mines at work. And all of a sudden, you go through a period of that and people start painting abstracts, for example. Mm-hmm. And they say, my God, what is that? That's frivolous. It's not in the best interest of the state because it doesn't represent, as you say, our ideals. If it's bad, that scares them, it's dangerous. That's one of the things that representational versus abstract.
Sherry.
Sherry.
When Paul mentioned trying to find a reason for bulldozing the art, a quotation that somebody had concerning art, who stated the hallmark of the artistic enterprise is the effect of surprise, took on new meaning, because I think they were not interested in having surprises. Their mind is ordered and their five-year plans are laid out and the political theology is written and stamped and impressed in the mind of people. And the artist is interested in creating fresh and new ideas and expressing it that way. I also brought to mind a print that we have at the house done by Creta Kent. And she has some bold purple, green, blue, yellow stripes. And then across the bottom in her typical lettering, she has written, believe in God is to know that all the rules are fair and one of the wonderful surprises. The artist lives in that frame of reference.
Would you repeat that again?
To believe in God is to know that all the rules are fair and the wonderful surprises. I think that's anathema to the Soviet state. I remember being in Berlin and walking between West and East Berlin and seeing the sterile architecture part of the East from one building after another was exactly the same. There were no surprises. And then going back again to the life of the part of West Berlin. Some variety. Some architecture.
Now, several of you are saying that art is nonconformist, perhaps rebellious by its very nature, and that
no.
That in itself may engender angry responses from some political regimes. You say no. Let me call on your wife first, and then.
Was really well accepted and was considered a very good communist and tremendous writer. And Solzhenitsyn, tremendous writer. I enjoyed equally both writers. And I read several things by both of them. And I was trying to think why the Russians in answering Paul, why Sholokhov was so in favor and Solzhenitsyn not. And yet, both were equally excellent writers. And the one thing that rebellious, you could say maybe the Solzhenitsyn, but Sholokhov, no. And yet, in some ways, he was. But the thing that came through clearly, as I thought this through, was that Sholokhov showed the Russian people. He has a beautiful metaphor, a beautiful style, but it was didn't leave you with it wasn't a question style so much. Beautiful metaphors, beautiful language. And he really showed a very realistic picture of the Russian people through the revolution and everything. And yet it didn't leave you with a question inside as much. And then Solzhenitsyn, though, in Camp 4, which is the first one I read, again, the Russian people, but you were left with a real question inside. His style, his tone, left questions, and I wondered if that is why the Russian, he was always on the out. Where Sholokhov was very well equipped, equally good writer, except Sholokhov didn't leave that off the question inside. That's the only thing that I came up with. I mean, and yet they both show. Can you add anything back to Jack? Jack is very poor too. Okay.
Well, you know, somebody over here wanted to take issue with the idea that art was rebellious or nonconformist.
Well, not necessarily. I have my hand up a couple times. Way in the beginning of this conversation, the very beginning of this session, I just wondered if we're putting stipulations on creativity.
How so?
Are we? That's what I want to know. Are we saying only an artist is creative?
Mm.
because that's all I hear of trusting. Only someone who is rebellious is creative. Only someone who does other than the norm is creative.
I think that's one of the questions that's going around. And I think it's a question because there is a frequent response to artists in the broad sense, which is negative. And why?
I'd like to just say, I don't agree that that the creative act is rebellious. I would hope that we could at least begin with that it's non-conventional, and it may slide on a scale to be so non-conventional that it might threaten the society in which gave it, which spawned it. But the non-conventionality, you know, can take many degrees of heat. But it's not a conventional way of looking at things or of dealing with the world.
That's where I would have some problems with that. I think that I find it extremely conventional. Or I, you know, let me put it another way, I don't find it unconventional. I don't think in terms of conventional or unconventional, or rebellious or non-rebellious. It's just something that exists. Like, I don't find people rebellious, or some people are, some artists are, some plumbers are very rebellious, some preachers are not, some are. So I don't think we ought to compartmentalize artists from anybody else.
The product is non-conventional. The artist may not be, but the product is. That's what it is. It is a creative product.
Like what?
Your poetry. Each poet, each piece of poetry is different. It's different from what anybody else has said.
That's in the very definition of creativity. If you do exactly what someone else does, that's not creative. It's also unconventional. I mean, it's also conventional. I think it's true that, to a certain extent, every piece of art is somehow rebellious, because if it can't follow exactly the norm of something else, or it isn't creative in the first place. So there's a grain of truth in that, even though there has to be a grain of truth in that, to a certain extent.
I can agree with that to a certain extent, but when you look at art and you see on totally different sides of the world, people who never had any kind of contact at all are doing the same thing. Does that mean they're not creative?
Creativity is
the same, not never really the same.
Creativity is more of a personal thing anyway. If you do something that's completely new, even if 1,000 other people have done it, but you're not aware of that, it is still creative for you. Still a creative event.
It seems to me to answer the question, we have to think in relative terms, and we have to think of our 20th century world and society. What is art for our society? What is the norm? What's to be conventional? Our society is pretty. I see it as mechanized. To be conventional is the way you are to be, and therefore to be creative and artistic is to be rebellious against the norm. And it seems to me that's what's happened in the Soviet Union and in many of the countries that have become very much Western. Plato.
I don't think it has to be rebellious. You can be doing something that is different from what other people are doing, not because you are against it or because you're rebellious of it, just because you want to do something different. You have a feeling that you want to do it your way.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think to say that you want to do it your way is to be rebellious.
No, we're talking about two different definitions.
There's another sense in which rebellion is a kind of angry and destructive business, and No, right, I don't think so either. But I mean, I think just to say that you're doing something your own way because you want to do it your own way, I mean, sometimes.
In an ordered society where you're not allowed to do that, and you say, that's what I want to do, and I'm going to do it because I want to do it, then that would be considered rebellious.
Yeah.
In that term, in those terms, we're in our society.
There's a question of limit, too. Yeah.
Just to go back for a second to that whole Russia question, I think what might, I don't know if it confuses the issue more or it clarifies it. In the first, well, at least 10 years of the communist regime, the Russian artists were the, you know, the vanguard of the world in terms of, well, I'm talking about visual artists now, in terms of painting and architecture and this and that. I mean, they were the most innovative and experimenting and alive artists, you know, and they were thriving under this new, you know, communist atmosphere after the Tsar is overthrown. When things settled down, you know, when there became a real convention that was to be followed, that's when the crackdown on art started. I don't know. You know,
but it wasn't. I think it's important to notice that the crackdown wasn't universal. Ballet, music, painting, literature proceeded with different degrees of freedom and success. And I think that's worth reflecting. I don't know what to draw from that. You were talking about the. They didn't want anybody to reach into the transcendent because they had all the answers. But I wonder, I have trouble reconciling that with the obvious devotion of Russian leaders to the ballet. And,
was not a traditional ballet, but then it became...
Well, maybe.
Yeah, I think that we're getting into some complex areas that we're perhaps not at all prepared to deal with. I mean, talking about the character of the Russian people and so on, but yeah.
Would you mind just really briefly restating your first two premises? Just really briefly. Because I think to me something's left out.
Okay, if I can at this point. What I was suggesting was that if we were to consider the question of the relationship between art and society, that there are two frequently heard responses of what the relationship ought to be. One is that that art is fairly benign, that it's something that goes on, and that if you have extra resources, then you might encourage it, preserve it, show it, circulate it, whatever. But that if you don't have those resources, you're not going to worry too much about it. Art is something that just happens, it's part and parcel of society and so on. Another response is that art is something which is extraordinary, it's powerful, it changes people's minds, it has an impact on the way people act, and needs to be regulated very carefully, that it's potentially very dangerous. And the examples that I gave of that, and I think that they rest on somewhat different assumptions, was one, the Soviet example, and then two, the example of Plato's Republic. Then, the parallel question, or what I conceived as a parallel question, had to do with our understanding of the creative impulse in individuals. Sometimes we think of it as just as natural as anything. We're all creative, we ought to foster our creativity, are naturally creative people, and it's something that if you have leisure, if you have resources and so on and so forth, then maybe you can devote some specific time to it. Maybe you can take music lessons, or maybe you can devote some time and money to painting and so on. But if you don't, it doesn't make too much difference, because we are all creative people anyway. And it's the kind of thing that time and inclination are such, then you'll pursue it, otherwise you won't. Then it seems to me there's another view which says that no, there's something about the creative impulse which is genuinely demonic, and sometimes this takes people over and leads them and really directs them. And this is something which ought to be controlled and regulated. Now, the manner of the control and regulation varies depending on your point of view. Some people say we've got to liberate those demons because they're going to really, you know, be the vanguard of expressing what's truly human. And others say, no, we've got to stifle it. There's something, you know, dreadfully unsavory about it. So now, thinking of the, you know, the analysis of the creative impulse in the individual and the status of the arts in society, it occurred to me that there was a kind of parallelism there, and it seemed to me that was interesting. And that, I guess those aren't premises, but it raised my curiosity in a certain way.
What about a third point of view? I mean, there must be probably 10,000 points of view. But one that says not only is art just benign, and it's okay if you do and okay if you don't, or it's demonic, but that art is very, very positive. Nothing demonic about it. It's not something that society can do without or do with. It's something that society and every person needs, because every society has brought it forth. It seems to me that...
No, the distinction was between it being benign and it being powerful. And then powerful, yeah, could be regarded as in either a positive way or a negative way. Yeah.
I thought you were putting emphasis on the demonic too much.
Yeah, well, I meant a kind of daimon as a vital spirit that in the individual...
Which is positive.
That's right, yeah.
I think.
I mean, sometimes regarded positively, sometimes regarded negatively.
If people regard it negatively, it seems to me that, and I know some people do, some people are... The 19th century, if your daughter became an actress, tell that. And my mother, when she found out I wrote poems, was a little concerned.
Yeah.
I played football and was concerned. But I think that's because you're the philosopher, I'm the poet, so I'll let you word this correctly. It seems that you can get into the good and evil, the good and bad part of it, the Apollonian dynastic qualities of people. But sometimes we artists do ruffle feathers and seem unconventional, simply because I think they're plucking the strings that everybody has. And sometimes you don't want those strings plucked. But for me, that's not being unconventional at all. Because if we respond to things, it's because the responses are already in us. And I don't see anything that's inside you cannot be unconventional or unusual in any way.
Are there very persuasive people that make television commercials and color layouts for magazines, artists?
Sure. Mm-hmm. I don't run in that crowd, so I don't know. I think that probably some are and some aren't.
I think, you know, just saying that really makes the distinction clear, because it may be that the group who's discussing it here is atypical. I see a lot of professors and artists and teachers. We're a very small part of society. And when you speak of the relationship between art and society, we've spoken an awful lot more from our own personal feelings about art and not maybe general society. And general society is the television commercial makers and watchers, and the magazine layout readers. So I think if we're going to answer that question, we have to maybe step out of our own shoes to answer it.
Well, are you suggesting then that, that the consensus of society is what determines what is or is not art?
In societal terms, sure. If society is going to determine what is art and what is not art, how else can you define it?
Mm.
I guess we really haven't, have we?
Isn't it a pretty classical story that the person who goes into advertising, if they could have made money otherwise, if they read an art, would have.
Maybe it's the tool of the artist to use it manipulatively. So I don't think that's a question of art, and maybe that's another phase of using the tools and manipulating it from, say, from a commercial or something.
I don't know, in the discussion we had earlier, the one that just preceded this on art, the question came up, what is it, well, I think it was going to come up, but I mentioned what is art, and one thing that the person I spoke said that art is creative, when the word creative came up, but it was hand things that a person had done, painting, visual things, et cetera, et cetera. It were acts that were done, and it wasn't really mentioned as to the purpose, as to why it was done, or as to, you know, creativity was probably involved in that, but it wasn't. And I guess that's a valid question. We've been talking about art quite a bit. And I don't know if we really know what it is.
I think that's what was discussed, was that there was something behind it, which was to have a relationship with the world that we see, and to come to some understanding about it. And self-soap is a different question than to perceive the world. I think to understand things in visual terms and record it, to experience it and understand.
Well, that question did come up. You had asked whether you ever meaning with the intent to please someone. The end result before you even start, and that would be the difference. Whether you're painting to creatively express something, create a meaning to something, tell your reaction to it, or are you starting out with a premise that you're the end result before you
just because you're trying to please them, it's not art?
No, the end result before you begin. No, you're manipulating.
I can't agree that that is by any definition of creativity that I know that the creative ad producer is not creative or that the ad
creative.
I think they are. I think they're right on. They match the definition of creativity.
Whatever. And they're really good craftsmen too. Yeah. I mean, they handle the materials really well.
Well, I wanted to say something before though about the notion that there is a. Can we at least agree that there's no such thing as collective art? I mean, there's no such thing as group art, strictly speaking, or maybe.
Well, I don't know what you mean. I mean, a symphony orchestra is a group, so you have to.
Well,
is the performance the art?
Yeah.
But don't we see a difference between a journalist and a writer and a fiction and poetry and historical writer and a poet? We differentiate in the writing field. I think you do in the
field. Well, we differentiate them among.
We can be creative in different ways, but I think we do consider one that works from imagination and from.
The
problem is this whole discussion we've been talking about art in a broad sense, yeah. And now all of a sudden we're trying to talk about fine art, and it's going to throw the whole thing off because we can start all over again. I think it's a difference in intent. That's probably, wouldn't you re-ask the main difference? The difference in intent between a creative person and an artist. But we've been talking all night. According to what I thought, we've been talking about creativity, which means our art in the broad sense. When you're just looking at creativity, you're not necessarily looking at the intent.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. You know, I think the discussion has gotten trapped by a determination to glorify creativity and art. And we suspended our critical faculties a little bit by that desire to be on the side of the angel.
Yeah, that thought went through my head a couple times about, I guess I have a little system, a Soviet Union system in me about classes and discussing different kinds of art. I wasn't even willing to call fairly creative or something. And then there are other things that other people may look at that way, and I might think are just the flow of life. And somehow they're so much different from each other. And every once in a while I want to throw a pop shot at some things, some kinds of art and creativity. And kind of when we said magazine producers, that was kind of a dirty word or something, kind of art. I kind of agree with that.
Yeah, let me make a couple of observations. I was generally thinking of art as the artifacts which were the result of the creative process, and not trying to discriminate among them in terms of whether one was true art or not. But it seems to me that we all do all the time say that this is art and this is not art, you know. And for example, I'm inclined to say that certain kinds of music are art, and certain other kinds of music that you hear more often on the radio are not, you see. And I want to stifle that. I mean, I really do, you know. But I think that if I'm a clear, rational person, I understand that the creative efforts of the person or the performing group that has made the, you know, what I regard as noise that I don't like, quite analogous, you see. So that this kind of thing happens, and we've I think in this discussion not really faced up to the fact that some things that some people want to call art are offensive, and we don't like it, and we don't want it around, you see. And it's not simply in the Soviet Union where this happens. You know, it happens there more officially, perhaps, sometimes, but it happens all the time in our lives. A second observation is that, and at one point in the discussion I thought we were going to get on this, but then we didn't. It's relatively recent in the history of culture that we've put such a high value on being creative. I mean, we all seem to want to be on the side of being creative, and we hold that up as a very desirable sort of thing, but it's fairly recent. The notion of being creative is not significant in the history of Western thought, even for all that long. Thirdly, it's interested me that terms like truth, honesty, expression of what's right, what's good, you know, these terms were never mentioned, you know. These kinds of value terms never came up. But surely some of the reasons why people abhor certain kinds of art and go and embrace other kinds of art have to do with the fact that we believe that they're right on, you see. To refer to Plato, I mean, the reason that Plato wanted to ban the poets from the city, from the most just city, was because he said the poets are inclined to just say whatever is going to be said well, going to be said beautiful, is going to be persuasive, and so on, without any regard for the truth. You know? That is what we have to watch out for with the poets, is that they tell beautiful untruths, and people believe them, and that's bad for them. So I thought it was curious then, that in the course of the discussion, that those kinds of terms never came up at all. So I don't know what you want to make out of these observations, but I've been fascinated by the sorts of things that were said tonight, and just as fascinated by the things that, were not there. So, I promised you that I had to go pack, but are there any concluding kinds of remarks that anyone wants to make? Before I leave, you can sit and talk as long as you want.
I just would list something I made hearing in the discussion about the creativity factor. But I just have a sentence from you, is that in creativity, or being creative, I think that, people who, a person who puts mandarin oranges in a casserole or something, and just does it to make a difference, and does it without there being rules, that's a creative act. And from a spot to build a water wheel on and sometimes in our life when we needed to go on a whip more creativity with more of that necessity. Maybe it's yeah, I mean really we have to be creative back to go now getting older. But that's another part of it. It's not just making pictures.
Yeah. Yes, I don't really agree with your second point. You're saying there's more emphasis on creativity now. I think there's always an emphasis, and always has been. If anything, the middle-aged craftsman was more creative because you had to make do with less. You couldn't just go down to the store and buy it.
But I think that's more of a recent upsurge in creativity and the fact that that people seem to have this urge to create and to make, you know, whether utilitarian objects or just make things just to be making things. I think that, in spite of the fact that people, like you said, constantly or always possess these strings that you know that need plucking, and that we all have these creative urges, that you know, why is there this recent upsurge in this desire?
Yeah,
because of the rush of our ordered lives. You know, as our lives become more and more ordered, we need to get out from underneath that burden of always doing things the same way.
Let me clarify my point, because I think you misunderstood it. And then I didn't mean to say, I don't think I said, that people are more creative now than they were before, but rather the way in which we honor creativity is fairly recent.
You don't think it was honored back at that time? That's a better craftsman?
And by fairly recent, I mean since the 13th century. By creativity. we began by talking about 35,000 BC. by being creative, I mean doing something which is novel, utterly new, not done before. Okay?
Like that guy who made the first wheel with no step up, huh?
No, probably not at all.
You think so?
One way, I'll never forget. One way that the artists or creativity is more emphasized, or one way in which it was not as emphasized as it is now, as an example, would be someone like Chaucer. We all think the Canterbury Tales is a great work, very funny or bawdy or whatever. Chaucer, when he was writing it, was not a great artist, wasn't a great writer. He was a courier for the king. He spent some time in jail. He made wine. He made babies. He did all kinds of things. He just, one of the things he did was write Canterbury Tales. We know nothing about Shakespeare, literally nothing. We're not even sure when he was born. Exactly. He just didn't leave all kinds of records. He was just somebody who wanted to write these kinds of things. The idea of the artist as a special or different breed of cat is a relatively kind of 19th century phenomenon. The Romantic Revolution and all that kind of thing. I guess the point I wanted to make, forgot to make it, was that when I said in the beginning that I thought art and artists and people were, all, everybody was creative, and I wasn't really trying to be on the side of the angels with that. It's just that I didn't want to make it sound saccharine. It's just that it seems to me so natural that in the 13th century or in the Renaissance, that it was a person, just you sat a horse well, you handled a rapier, you made love, and you wrote, you baked bread, you painted. It was something you did. And now we've come a long way down the wrong track. It seems to me that we even had a discussion like this. It's rather bizarre, but fine.
Yeah?
Just something you said just recently kind of bothers me, that you said being creative is doing something novel. That bothers me because that, to me, that stifles creativity.
Well, it puts an impossible demand on it, yeah, almost.
And so many people, I think that's why so many people are stifled, because they say, I can't do that.
Yeah.
Or I can't do something that is so novel that just knocks the world out. And that's why they say, forget it, I don't want to be a part of it.
I think that some of the conceptual and other kinds of blocks we have against creativity stem from the environment we're in, the culture that we're in, and when we start to do things that are really creative, we often have to work a little bit at removing some of these kinds of blocks. You know, think beyond the four dots type of thing. And I think also that there's levels of creativity. There's a proverb or something that says that you only do two or three really creative things in your life. I think while we're doing it all the time, we may be doing it at a more superficial level. But even an artist has the great moments. And I think it's similar to some of these other discussions that we've been having, especially on loneliness too. There are different levels of these kinds of things. A small child is very creative. And for something which may not be creative for an adult, it may be very creative for a child, and we grow into it.
Somewhere along the line, there's suppression, because I teach ninth grade art, and it's really interesting for me to be out here. I'm in Narnia working, and to be with the kids and to listen to them and be around them. They're refreshing for me, because I get ninth grade students who are already to that point of saying, I can't do this. Why do we have to do this? I've never done it before, or I know I can't. And somewhere in those few years, they've already been told, or somehow they've got the impression that they can. And they haven't been encouraged to think, I'll try to succeed. It's rather, you can't do that.
Do you think that they believe that they can't because they can't achieve the technical standards that they believe are expected, or is it that they feel that they can't do anything novel, original, or some other reason that inhibits them?
Well, I think it's a combination of those. I think that some of their expectations may be too high, and they expect to be very knowledgeable and very meticulous about the technicalities of what they want to create, what they want to do, the technical aspect. And if they don't feel masterful of those, then they don't feel successful. And it's a combination of things.
It was really the prelude to what I was going to say afterwards, but I thought, well, I had said enough of other things by saying there is no such thing as collective art. And that is, it is an individual thing. And individualism, pushed to its extreme, is the death of society. It's far more than self-indulgence. It can kill society. Anarchy is the result of final expression of individualism. So there is, but on the other hand, a collectivism, it pushed to its extreme, is the ultimate death of the individual. And the problem is not so much, one or the other, but how can you bring these into reasonable tension with each other? How can you create a society in which you can be safe, but also in which you can allow enough of the creative act to permit the transformation, which is absolutely essential to an ongoing society. And that, to me, is why we need creativity like we need fire. You know, we need this, but we got to control it also. Control it not in the sense that finally we're going to throw a bucket of water on it. That's the ultimate control. But I think that could have been a cheap shot, Paul, on self-indulgence. I think it's far more than that. I think it's absolutely necessary for our society to have transformations happening, because we would be stuck with categories that would calcify us finally. We wouldn't be able to move. That is one response. The other response is the definition of creativity. I'm stuck with operational definitions. That's my field. The operational definition that has been brought to us, strangely enough, originated in Minnesota. That is, creativity has been used in a research way in psychology with four components, and for the life of me, I cannot think of the fourth one, even though I had a dissertation on it. One of them is fluency, and that is, a creative person does not just come up with one creative idea. The more creative, if you put a sliding scale on creativity, the more creative people compared to the less creative people simply can produce more ideas, many more ideas, given a given situation. And this is exhibited right around here by Betty Stuff. She's got a given stimulus, poppies, and see her responses to it, the multiple responses. So fluency is one thing. Another one is uniqueness, originality. Is the way that I'm addressing it, offering a conceptualization that is unique, and that can also be empirically measured. You can talk about categories, whether they're verbal or whether they're visual, they still can be creative. The third one is elaboration. When I said these were fluency, it could also be conceivably elaboration. How can you take the same stimulus and respond to it multiple ways? Multiple, multiple, multiple. And again, the sliding scale. As I said, I can't remember the fourth one, but that's how at least the operational definition would be approached within creativity. But I still think...
I don't want to, as a private argument, you misunderstood my... I didn't say that we should... What you said, I said.
Yes, you did. I heard you.
I said I could sometimes substitute the word self-indulgence for the word creative and make sense of it. Sometimes.
Yeah.
You have to know which statements I was talking about.
Yeah.
But, and we don't.
Your definition of creative makes railroad pre-creative. That's fine. But it doesn't help me, but I don't
know. Yeah, except that it's not human or you.
I admire when you stick here and muscle.
Yeah, that's a tiny one.
Harold comes with that.
Well, we've had another crystallizing and... Thank you all for participating.